You know that feeling when a song comes on and it's so good that it feels like you're frozen in time? Well, that's what my podcast In My Tracks is all about. The songs that stopped me in my tracks. I'm your host, Jada Burt, and I have revealing conversations with musicians about their creative challenges, mental health struggles, and the economic realities they're facing as independent artists today. And you discover your new favorite songs. Tune into In My Tracks everywhere you listen to podcasts.
What is up, y'all? This is your girl, Scarlett, a.k.a. Scardi B, a.k.a. your resident emo historian. And join me as we unpack the history of Fall Out Boy and hip-hop. Look, y'all, we got a lot to cover in this podcast, so strap on in, because, sugar, we're going in. What is up, y'all? Hey. I know what you're thinking. Oh, no, Scardi, they let her out, you know, they let her out the nursing home. Like, she's been on the fridge, she's been going rogue, and it's true. You know, like, I'm extra thankful to be recording this right now. Like, I know I've been quiet, but it's been for the best reason. I've been touring, I've been managing, I've been tour managing, and I've been traveling with the Lumineers building their VIP program. So I've been working at their bigger stadium dates, and this gig has had me have to enjoy travel. And, like, not that I did it, but, like, I did it not hate it. And the thought of not being home like 4 days of the week, like, gave me the big sads, like the gigantic sads. But I digress. As part of, like, getting to enjoy travel, like, I make sure that I have, like, one touristy thing to do, like a little carrot, a little, you know, something to, like, keep me going, right? I need a dopamine hit as soon as I arrived and, like, get off this big scary plane. I've been from, like, everything from, like, Casa Bonita in Denver to, like, the sweetest, like, hole-in-the-wall record place in, like, Washington, D.C. And, like, tonight I'm recording to you live from Detroit, where by symptoms of my lurky girl syndrome, like, I happened to grab the last tour of the Motown Museum that was available through the entire weekend that I'm here. And it's a very interactive guided tour that made me sing and made me laugh and made me cry. And, like, most importantly, it just appreciate music history and the, you know, the excellence that, like, poured out of those walls. And, like, I won't spoil the interactive parts, but if you are ever around Detroit, Michigan, I highly recommend the visit. But please, like, book ahead of time online. It's surreal. And just, like, the music made in those rooms influenced so much of the music that we hear today, like, in one way or another. Like, whether it's a six sample or a flip or a groove, like, not only would it, like, Motown in general, like, change the way that music is recorded, but it also changed the way that artists would be discovered. Like, they are, like, these huge names, like the Supremes, Stevie Wonder, the Four Tops, and these are household names, but this was long before, you know, they were these smash hit stars. They were working with an A&R named Barry Gordy, and Barry's, like, vision was to, like, bring and distribute all these artists, right? And, like, Barry's vision would be, like, of a touring review, right? So he's like, I need a showcase of these rotating acts, where, like, he knew that, like, the only way to get in front of people and get people excited, obviously, is to make the concerts yourself. And so he was building the sickest bills around, and he just knew exactly how to get live feedback and how to continue that loop. And, you know, to further the vision of Barry Gordy, and, like, just Motown in general, like, his sister Esther Gordy, like, who knew that people would want to see where it all began, launched the studio to become the museum it is today. And it celebrates the musicians that are with us and not, and specifically the people who have graced the studio A walls. I mean, huge songs are made in there, like My Girl and everything in between, like so much of the Supremes and obviously a lot of Marvin Gaye and everything in between. But I promise you this is going somewhere. But, like, going into the museum, like, I knew I was going to record this tonight. So I was already feeling extra nostalgic. Like, I thought a lot about the importance of, like, a space like this to honor people who are here and people who have passed on. But, you know, most importantly, like, celebrating, again, people who are here now, letting them know that they're important, while also celebrating the people who have passed on. And, you know, I'm just putting that intention into this episode, even if it's only for you right now, my Shug listening. Okay, go back in time with me to 2011. While fans were busy digging into the Toronto VP, Patrick was doing something even bigger behind the scenes, and that was putting together a band to bring this music to life. And not just any band, right? Like a group of seasoned, just like simpatico genre blurring musicians that would bring, you know, Toronto Wave and later soul punk to life. This episode is about that band and some of those connections, and specifically a tribute to one of its most prolific members, the late, great Casey Benjamin. Per the last episode, Patrick wrote, recorded, produced, composed, sang, and played every note on his music. Like, it's very much giving Marc Jacobs by Marc Jacobs, you know, produced by Marc Jacobs, given by, made by, you know, delivered by Marc Jacobs. And whether it was like for the lack of professionalism or the lack of budget, because bands are an investment, they are expensive, especially good ones, or both, right? It's like the quest to like construct this community of musicians would really translate through his music and through like his intentionality with bringing them in. Like they really help bring the story and the music to life in a big way. But you also got to look the part, okay? The fashion at this time of like Tumblr fuel terror was like a confusing combo of business casual and going to the club, okay? So it was like flats, statement necklaces, blazers, headbands, eyeglasses without the lenses or prescriptions, like the works. Oh, and so many bow ties and moon boots and capes and fingerless gloves, which is why you could find all of the above from bow ties on Patrick Stomp while he was walking on stage. He was wearing all of the above. It was definitely a fashion choice of the time. I highly respect it, and I think I love the moon boots. But this iconic outfit and most of his outfits on tour match the very sharp, bright energy of this synthy music, but leaves room for the camp and the theater and the juxtaposition that comes with the delivery of these emo ass lyrics. R.E. dance miserable. The music was roaring, the fits were fitting, and it was time for Patrick to debut his backing band. Touring is one of the most essential parts of an artist's career, like not just creatively, but financially, right? It's how many artists connect with their fans, they refine their craft, they promote their latest work, but it's also one of the most riskiest and most misunderstood aspects of the music business. It feels and looks very glamorous. It emotionally and physically is extremely tolling, but like even the biggest names in music don't turn a profit from touring. So imagine like local bands coming up. So that's why you should support everybody. Anyway, but between like crew pay and like gear rentals, travel, lodging, production costs, the numbers add up fast. And if you're self-funding your tour, as many artists do, the financial burden can be staggering. You know, you might not have a Berry Gordy who, you know, can really flip a bill and make sure that you're making at least a suitable per diem on top of anything else. But anyway, I'll stop the industry talk anyway. But again, the financial burden can be super staggering. And this was especially true for Patrick, like during this like Toronto Wave soul punk solo era. Like he was taking huge artistic and monetary risks to bring his vision to life. And that including building a touring band from the ground up. When Toronto Wave dropped in early 2011, fans weren't totally sure what to expect, but it signaled like a clear departure and that Patrick was serious about doing something different and ready to flex his like musical director, like MD role with bringing these songs to life with this full band experience. He did the whole like one man band for like a couple of the first shows while he was kind of like feeling out the music. Like I said, Barry put people on the road to sharpen their teeth, and it's like that, you know? It might sound great in a room, but getting it in front of people is really where you can get that feedback. And I think that feedback was, you know, it's fun to play all my songs all the time, but I need that chemistry. I need support to make it sound bigger and fuller, the way this sound was meant to be captured, which is with like a full live band. And, you know, as a producer, as a composer, like Patrick would be able to focus more on musical directing rather than playing 13 instruments at the same time. It's heroic, literally God's strongest soldier. But by all accounts, like he could have coasted, you know, like really cut the corners. Like we hear about people all the time treating bands like bullshit. Like he could have totally been like, I'm Patrick Stump, like being my man, was involved, you know, but like that's just, we know that's not him. And like he, again, just wouldn't have pulled that, understanding the respect that he has for live musicians. And, you know, by all accounts, like he could have, again, just like been coasting through all of this and you know, but his intentionality really brought it to the forefront of like why this was a success. So he said himself in a Spin interview, listen to this. So he said, I've made enough money as the singer for pop punk chart toppers, honestly leaving it in, Fall Out Boy, to retire modestly to a suburb. And instead he risked it all. He says, I took my money and I invested in properly recording what I was trying to say so I could get the ball rolling. It says that Patrick wasn't chasing labels approval. He fronted the money himself. He was writing, recording, and producing every part of the album and learning how to engineer on the fly. Patrick goes, I probably could have done the same record for a lot less if I knew more about engineering. He obviously confessed. But the expenses didn't stop once the album was finished. That article continues to talk about to tour soul punk later on, he needed a live band and a great one. And that meant another wave of costs on top of making this album. But Patrick goes, I spared no expense on my band. I wanted to treat them really well. That's where I spent everything. And that's including up to $3,000 a week for a quality touring keyboardist. And that's before expenses. And this was his personal investment, right? Patrick's, not label support. And at one point, Patrick even said, I haven't made a dollar on these shows. I've lost money. Ultimately, it's like having and opening a small business. Patrick said that he wasn't above sleeping on friends' floors either, even during sold-out shows. Patrick goes, I can sleep on a floor. I'm comfortable doing that. I'm taking the risk. Eventually, Patrick admitted that he might accept label tour support, but if only it's to help get over that hump, quote, end unquote. So the risks are staggering, but the rewards are absolutely so tasty, and I personally think worth whatever stress went through it. I think if you're going to do something, go full hog. And this band was full hog. Let's kick off about the band. And I'll start with an emo tie-in. I know my audience. Okay. So let's talk about on the bass, Matt fucking Rubano of Taking Back Sunday. It's a very unexpected, but like a perfect pick for Patrick's like soul punk band moving forward. Like most fans obviously know him from his time with Taking Back Sunday, but like Matt's roots go way deeper than like the hardcore scene. Like long before joining Taking Back Sunday, like he trained at a super prestigious Manhattan School of Music, and he studied jazz performance and earned a reputation as like a highly technical like bassist. That classical and jazz foundation gave him the ability to adapt quickly across genres, anything a good touring or session musician would do. But it made him specifically perfect for Patrick's genre hopping vision that was coming together. But here's the kicker that most fans don't know, like you would if you were amazing. I listened to my interview with James Montgomery, plug, plug, plug. But Matt Rubano, and here's his tie-in with hip hop. I'm not fucking crazy. I feel like I'm wearing a tinfoil hat whenever I'm fucking recording this. Matt Rubano played bass on Lauryn Hill's Everything Is Everything. Yes, that fucking track, like from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. It's Apple literally named it the number one album of all time, and or of the century or whatever. It's the best. And that iconic bass line is Matt Rubano. And it's a surprising, again, hip hop credit that connects historic directly to like this lineage of like neo soul and classic 90s hip hop and the Minneapolis sound and R&B and everything that he was able to flex while in Patrick's band. Next is Scooter Warner, and he was on the drums, and he is one of those names that comes across a ton of like mutual collaborations. Like before joining Patrick's live band, he played with Raw and like alt metal bands, but his background goes, like, again, far beyond heavy music. Like, he has played for Cyndi Lauper and artists like Modest Yahoo, and he was known for a really, like, powerful playing style and his finesse, right? Like, he could drive the energy of a rock set, but then, like, lay back and find a pocket and a groove, you know, that he could mix in perfectly with any R&B, you know, singer, songwriter. But for soul punk, like, that dynamic was so essential. Like, he was an engine, he was booming, and he was the one shifting gears between, like, punchy tracks and, like, laid back tracks. And I think for what soul punk and the set list in general ended up being, like, Scooter was a really great fit. On guitar was Michael Day. Michael Day, like, he must be, like, I think the most elusive of the lineup. I don't know much about him, but, like, he was always super kind. He was a very expressive player. He was always super fun and engaging on stage. And, like, it was obvious that he was a very fluid, like, educated player. And what I love about seeing good musicians like this is that you can tell, like, these guys know all their foundations. And because of that, they can fuck with it and make it cooler and twang it and make this sound that ended up being the sound for this live band. Finally, there was Casey, and he was the soul of the band. He was a veteran of Mos Def and Q-Tip's live setups and, like, a core member of jazz alt band Robert Glasper Experiment, and he blended synths and jazz and hip hop and funk into this this musicality that was building between this band. And he would play, like, these wild, like, sax solos on stage for a minute and then lay down, like, a robotic vocoder harmonies for the next. And, like, he just wasn't just a keyboardist or a horn player. Like, he was a sound sculptor. He was an engineer of vibes, and always with a smile on his face. So I definitely just wanted to give him the biggest shout out for creating some beautiful synergy up there, and watching him interpret Patrick's music. I think everybody was equally in awe of what we were listening to. And what's really, really special is that just a year later, him and Patrick share the stage for a cover of Black Hole Sun at Apple's UK Music Festival. And this was Patrick being a special guest on this set. And I will play that song in its entirety at the end of this show. But Patrick's jazz roots go way deeper. The live band starts their set with John Coltrane's Giant Steps. Obviously, John Coltrane being an incredibly prolific musician. And just knowing that, like, these interpolations still live on as a way to, like, hype people up. Like, again, just going back to just, like, my Motown Museum experience and, like, seeing that all come together in a way that I get to really enjoy and, you know, be inspired by so many years later is really special. So I'll definitely keep, you know, picking at the Fall Out Boy, Patrick Stump, hip hop, jazz chain. I know there's something there. I'm picking away, okay? The openers for this tour were equally as impressive and amazing. They included Winter Gordon, and you might not know her now as Diana Gordon. She was featured on Lil Yachty's Drive Me Crazy. I saw her on an SNL performance of it recently, but, like, I got to see her open for Patrick back in 2011 multiple times. Ride in Paris, Rocky Fresh, Upperclassmen, and Dawn T, who is an incredible singer-songwriter, but also happens to be the sister of Philly's freshest drummer, DJ, filmmaker, and rump shaker, Amir Questlove Richardson. And, like, if there's anything you, my Shug, who's obviously listened to every episode multiple times of this show, is that Questlove and the Roots love them some Patrick Stump, okay? Like, but can you blame them? Okay, goodbye. Now, after every opener came this, again, insane set by this band. I mean, let me just drop some bombs on you. First one, the live shows had a Dirt Off Your Shoulder remix by Jay-Z. And I actually have a DM from Patrick because I asked him from it. I was like, what is this medley compilation. And he actually DM'd me back going, it's actually a medley. We play Dirt Off Your Shoulders by Jay and Nothing But a G Thing by Dre underneath it. And I go, no way. And he goes, dead fucking serious. Haha. Listen to it on YouTube. And then he also plays an interpolation of Art of Noise, Moments in Love, which is one of the best songs of all time. But I'm absolutely going to play the Dirt Off Your Shoulders and Nothing But a G Thing medley that is played at the top of the intro, because just listen to this, it's absolutely crazy. Okay, so now you understand why I saw that in 2011 with my own two eye holes and listened to it with my own two ear holes. And I wasn't supposed to make a podcast about Fall Out Boy and hip hop. Like, please be for fucking real. But you know what? Finally, I think 20 minutes is just enough right now for me to continue to yap. And I'll leave you with this cover of Black Hole Sun by the Robert Glasper Experience featuring Patrick. It was recorded in 2012. Just rest in peace to the prolific Casey Benjamin. Like, again, your joy in playing music was palpable. You made clubs feel like stadiums, and you will be very, very missed. On the next episode, we will talk with Professor M of the Upperclassmen, who I mentioned earlier opened for Patrick during his solo dates. He's going to tell the story. Guys, get this, wait. He's going to tell the story of being the first and only song, of having the first and only song to sample Pavlov and get it cleared, okay? Cleared moments before it's played live on stage. Like, you'll have to tune in and hear him, like, tell it, because I was sweating just thinking about it. I might have blacked out, but after that, the week of October 18th, I will celebrate the 14-year anniversary of Soul Punk with the Soul Punk episode covering all things of the LP and obviously the Lupe Fiasco feature. Okay, so see you suckas on the other side, and happy Soul Punk repressing release day to all those who celebrate. May the odds be ever in your favor, but be nice to yourself because you're amazing and you deserve it. Okay, here he goes. Bye.
Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away the rain? Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come, won't you come? Sleep in my soul, I pray I change.
Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan from Fall Out Boy, my man. That was Black Hole Sun.